Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at I Eat Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I have a great show for all of you today. My guest will be Julie Castillo. She is a college anthropology instructor and an author of a wonderful new book that we're going to talk about in a little while called Eat Local for Less. And I'll tell you more about her when I bring her on. But first, of course, I want to share with you some things going on in and around the city and some things in the news. Of course, the drama, the daily saga of our administration continues. And our president is planning to move forward with his agenda, slashing spending on education, undoing the Environmental Protection Act. He says he will have it dismantled by 2018. He's going to cut back on science, on all the poverty programs like welfare, SNAP, WIC. Probably school lunches will be slashed in there as well. It's just amazing. You know, and his quote of like, who could imagine that healthcare could be so complicated? Well, Stephen Colbert said it perfectly. He was like, who couldn't imagine? Everyone knew except you. You know, healthcare is complicated, and we know that. And the fact that he didn't know that was because he doesn't watch the news or pay attention. So we just are going to have to continue staying vigilant and doing what we can and, you know, joining in on protests and writing letters. And you have to believe that your local congressmen and representatives are feeling it. They are hearing it. They go, you know, came home last week to their town hall meetings and they were bombarded. All the offices are being inundated with phone calls and messages. The voicemails are backed up and it's just an incredible show of force from people who don't want to take this lying down. And of course, his, you know, latest ban on journalists from press briefings is just unprecedented. You know, you saw that in the Hitler regime, but certainly has not been part of our democracy. And it is scary. It is really scary. And we have to keep the love flowing, stay vigilant, working together with all different grassroots organizations across the lines and band together to create a strong movement. And of course, we have the People's Climate March coming up on April 29th. And before that, there's going to be a March for Science on April 22nd. So there's a lot of, you know, wonderful ways that you can take action and you know, show the government how we feel. And we really need to do that together. So something's going on around the New York area. There's a webinar that is starting March 2nd. Which is about navigating the Food Safety Modernization Act. Don't know what will be happening to that act as we move forward, but nevertheless, this is a free online course, and you can find out about all of these things on my website at ieatgreen.com. I list all these events, and if you have a local event that you would like me to share with my listening audience and newsletter circle, please send it to me, and I'd be happy to share it. Also, March 2nd through April 30th, Cornell is having a beekeeping course that they also are doing online. And I've already been talking to people for a couple of months now that this is the time. We're already getting late. If you want to keep bees and you want to get a beehive going for this spring, you really need to be ordering those bees. And I want to encourage people to take up beekeeping. My husband and I did it a few years ago, and the benefits are huge. My garden is great. You know, they are doing their magic and fertilizing and helping my garden grow. The honey that we have gotten, I think we got over 200 pounds of honey this past year, has been amazing. I've made lip balm with the honey or with the beeswax, and everyone loves the lip balm. So it's just a fascinating another way of becoming an activist and helping our planet. Slow Food North Shore, which is my local slow food chapter, is co-sponsoring a documentary film called Seed, The Untold Story. And that's going to be played at the Plaza Cinema and Media Arts Center in Patchogue. And there are two different times. The March 4th one is 10:30 in the morning, but the March 9th one is 7:30 in the evening. And I haven't yet seen the film, but plan on attending the evening screening of this. So if you are in the Long Island area and are interested, it should be a great film. It's about preserving our seeds and diversity in our crops. As we all know, with the introduction of industrial agriculture, we lost so much of our regional and biodiversity crops, and we want to see what we can do to bring them back. So this film should be really perfect for that. March 6th, the Food Policy for Breakfast series is continuing. This is part of the New York City Food Policy Center at Hunter College. They will be having a breakfast presentation called Chefs Who Are Working to Improve the Food System. And that's Monday, March 6th from 8:30 to 10 a.m. They're free. They also offer a great breakfast. So they do ask you to register, though. So go on to the New York City Food Policy Center's website and sign up to come. March 9th and 10th, NOFA New York, which is our Northeast Organic Farming Association, they are having two brainstorming sessions down in the New York area. They had one last month on Long Island. March 9th is going to be in Brooklyn. March 10th is in the city. They're from 7 to 9:30 at night. Again, the information's on my website or the NOFA website. And they just want to know how can they, as a nonprofit organization and as a voice for organic farmers, how can they help you better as urban farmers, people down in the city and in Brooklyn, and of course us on Long Island too. They want to really be servicing us and helping helping us, and of course they need our help as well. So it's just a brainstorming session, and if you are working on growing vegetables, working in any urban farms, community gardens, anything like that, please come out to these meetings. They will be great. March 10th, Standing Rock and the Native Nations are having a march in Washington, D.C. There's also going to be a march in New York City, I believe, as a march in solidarity. And there could be others around the country as well. I'm actually not positive about that, but check it out. I'm sure if you go to the Standing Rock or Native Nations website, you can find out more about that. And I do have some links on my website as well. March 11th, the Long Island Keep Calm and Run for Local Office is a event from the Working Families Party, and they are partnering with Long Island activists and Long Island Progressive Coalition, and it's a running to win. It's a event that will take place at the Unitarian Church in Huntington, and it's free, and you can find out more about that as well on my website. March 12th, Slow Food North Shore is having their annual, it's actually our fourth annual, Food and Film Feast. That will take place at the Cinema Arts Center in Huntington. And this is an unbelievable event. Every year we sell out. This year we're pairing 9 short documentary films with food that is highlighted in the film, as well as a speaker that can address the topic of the film. It's a full 2.5-3 hour evening. The food is all organic and wonderful, cooked by myself at IE Green and my volunteers from my local Slow Food chapter. And it's just a great evening. It's, it really encapsulates all of your senses, from your ears, your eyes, your taste, smell, the whole works. So, like I said, it does sell out, so go onto the website and purchase your tickets. And hope to see you there. Just Food Conference is also having their annual conference, also on March 12th and 13th, although theirs is during the day, so you could actually go to theirs and then come out to ours. It's at Columbia University at the Teachers College. I've gone to the conferences before, and it's really a wonderful opportunity for people to come together who want to collaborate and learn from local enthusiasts on gardening and community gardens and farming and food equity issues. Really powerful 2 days. So if you can make it there, I really recommend it. Also, it's time to look into CSAs. If you're interested in community-supported agriculture, there are signups taking place now. Different areas are having their signups. You can also go to the website localharvest.com, or actually it might be .org. I'm sorry, you'll have to check that out. But Local Harvest is a great website to find your local CSAs, and you can interview them, basically. You can find out, you know, what kind of variety of vegetables do they grow? Make sure they're organic. You know, and again, I've said this before. For me, certification is not the important part. It's whether they're growing it in an organic way. I don't need the labels. If they don't want to participate in that, I have no problem. But I want it to be organic seed. I want them to be using organic growing methods that are sustainable, that are good for the earth, no pesticides, no herbicides, that kind of thing. So anyway, find out and find out how many pounds you get every week or an estimate, how long have they been doing it, all those kind of questions. It's really wonderful, though, purchasing your fruits and vegetables through a community-supported agricultural group, because you not only get the freshest vegetables that are picked right that day or week, but you're also becoming part of a community. And I think that's what I hear most from everybody that works with a CSA, is that being part of the community is really a wonderful thing. IE Green is also accepting applications now for interns for this summer. Every summer I take on about, you know, 3 to 4 interns that help work in the gardens, help with the bees. We make lunch together every day, so there's a cooking component to it, because one of the things that I advocate, as everyone listening knows, is cooking and cooking together with people. It's a wonderful thing, but I also like to teach my skills and pass them on to the next generation. So if you're interning with me, it's as much about gardening as it is cooking. Lots of other things going on. Like I said, the March for Science is April 22nd. The People's Climate March is April 29th. But check out my website and find out about all the different events going on. Lots of things going on in the news. As I mentioned, you know, the president, you know, had his press conference Tuesday evening. And, you know, it wasn't that shocking. I think it was what we all expected. But one thing I saw that came across my inbox that, again, for me was not that surprising, but I think most people have not heard about it, was the discussion about vaccinations, especially the HPV vaccine. I always try to tell people, follow the money, look at, you know, the businesses that are thriving. And, you know, we have a new drugstore, it seems like, on every corner. Drugstores are really, really thriving. And there's so much money made in drugs. And in our country, they do not require the type of testing that happens in other countries. Very often, things get approved before they're really ready to be approved. And then it's the public's job to raise attention to the fact that it's not working and then have to get it pulled off the market. That's how it's been with genetically modified fruits and vegetables. And now with this HPV vaccine, you know, just my gut said when they first came out with this vaccination, which is, you know, a vaccination to prevent supposedly ovarian cancer down the road. But what it is a vaccination that they're giving to young girls starting at the age of 8. And they are now finding many years later that this vaccination is connected to, and when this article actually is coming from the American College of Pediatricians. So it's not just some random, you know, left-wing article that I'm reading here. This is coming from the American College of Pediatricians. And it's a warning that this vaccination can cause an early premature ovarian failure. And what that really means is early menopause. So that girls in their adolescent years can go through menopause and as a result cannot have children. And when this vaccination first came out, I was like, you know, it wasn't actually approved for welfare recipients. Only insurance companies, expensive insurance companies were covering this vaccination. So I was like, won't this be ironic if, you know, all the well-off girls who got this vaccination, they couldn't have kids, and the only people that could have kids are people that were on welfare. That would be a reversal of outcomes, wouldn't it? But anyway, it's really raising concerns that this vaccination might be putting young girls into premature menopause, and they might not be able to have kids. So any time a vaccination comes out, a new vaccination, and your pediatrician is all so excited and they want you to run and sign up for it, think twice. How long has it been out? Have there been significant testing for this? It's just so important. We can't just all just jump on board and sign up every time a new drug comes out. You have to realize all the money that they make from these drugs. I remember when my kids were going off to college and they wanted to give the vaccination for spinal meningitis, or it was something like that. I don't even remember. Forgive me. But I just remember, because they were going into a college dormitory experience, they wanted them to have this vaccination. And I said, well, give me the information. And I read about it. And the amount of people that actually had a negative, that had the chance of catching this disease, and the amount of people that actually really got sick from the disease was so small that the idea of vaccinating a whole population or a whole segment of the population just seemed ridiculous to me. And of course, I did not agree to it. So, and then I did hear one person dying of that disease, and it was someone who had the vaccination. So just think twice, everybody. Just don't take things with, you know, just because someone says it, just don't do it. You need to become informed. You need to do your own research. You have to look at where the research comes from. If the research is being done by the pharmaceutical company, you have to take that with a grain of salt. Just like if we're being told GMOs are no problem and all the research is coming from Monsanto and DuPont, we got to look at that. You can't just take things as fact. You really need to see where it's coming from. Okay, so before I invite my guest on, I want to share with you my week's recipe. This is an orange ginger tofu over Asian vegetables with couscous. And, you know, I originally was making the recipe where I was cubing the tofu and it was all going to be, you know, except for the couscous being made in one pot, the rest of it was going to be made together in a wok. And then I, for whatever reason, felt like I didn't want the tofu to be cubed in my usual wok dish. I wanted the tofu to be in slices and be separate. So I did it that way. But if you don't want to dirty an extra pan and you want to put the tofu into the wok, you can do that as well. So there's three different components to this recipe. One's for the tofu, one's for the couscous, and one's for the vegetables. So for the tofu, you're going to need 1 cake of extra firm tofu that I cut into 12 slices, about 1/4 inch thick each. 1/2 cup of orange juice, 1 tablespoon of honey, 1 teaspoon of tamari, 1 tablespoon of apple cider vinegar, 2 teaspoons of minced ginger, and 2 teaspoons of minced garlic. For the couscous, you need 1 cup of whole wheat organic couscous, 3/4 cup orange juice, 1/2 cup of water, 2 teaspoons ginger, 3/4 teaspoon salt, 1 cup of chickpeas, canned chickpeas I used, so you want them already cooked. 1/2 cup of diced carrots cut into 1/4 inch pieces, and that was about 1 carrot. 1 cup of frozen organic peas and 1/4 cup of raisins. And for the vegetables, I used 1 onion cut into crescent moon shapes, 2 teaspoons of garlic, 2 teaspoons of ginger, 1 carrot cut into julienne strips, 1 small head of broccoli cut into florets, 2 cups of greens, and I used some kale and some bok choy, but you could also use spinach, Swiss chard, really whatever you have on hand, 1/2 cup of snow peas, 1/2 a red pepper, sliced into thin strips, 1 teaspoon cumin, 1/4 teaspoon of Chinese 5-spice, 1/4 cup of orange juice, 2 tablespoons tamari, 2 tablespoons cilantro chopped, 2 tablespoons of parsley chopped, and 1/4 cup of blanched almonds. So you're going to start by laying out the tofu on a dry towel, the tofu slices. Cover it with another towel and press lightly to dry the tofu slices. Meanwhile, you're going to boil some water and pour the water over the raisins. Just put the raisins into a little bowl, pour the boiling water over it, and let that sit for about 10 minutes, and then you'll drain it. You're going to combine the 3/4 cup of orange juice, the 1/2 cup of water, the 2 teaspoons of ginger, and the salt and the chickpeas in a saucepan, small saucepan, bring that to a boil. Add the diced carrots and let those cook for about 3 minutes just till they start to get soft. Then add the peas, cook for about another minute. Then stir in the couscous, cover the pot, and remove it. And the couscous just will cook in the boiling water without being on the heat anymore. You're just going to let that stand until we're ready to serve it. And before serving it, to fluff the couscous up, you use a fork and you mix it up with the fork, fluffing up the couscous. And you can add the drained raisins to that couscous as well. Meanwhile, you're going to cover the bottom of a cast iron frying pan with oil, and you're going to saute the tofu slices until they're golden brown on each side. And then you're going to remove them from the pan. And you're going to then put into that same pan a little bit more oil if the oil has dried up, the ginger and the garlic, and let that saute for a couple minutes. Then you're going to add the orange juice, the honey, the apple cider vinegar, and the tamari. Let that cook. You know, mix it up so that the honey dissolves. Then you're going to add the tofu back into that pan. Reduce the heat and let that simmer on a back burner for about 10 minutes. You can cover it. Just be careful not to let it burn. But just let that sit and go and take on the flavors of that sauce. The sauce ends up evaporating and being caramelized and, you know, just putting a really nice caramelized covering over the tofu. But you're just going to forget about that, put it on the back burner while you do the wok vegetables. And so you're going to cover the wok now with some oil. Add the onions, the carrots, the ginger, and the garlic, and cook that for a couple of minutes until it's soft. Then add the cumin, the Chinese 5-spice, the tamari, and cook that up. Then you're going to add the broccoli and the greens and let that cook for a bit. Then you're going to add the 1/4 cup of orange juice, which is just enough liquid to help steam the greens and get them really cooking. At the very end, you're going to add the red pepper and the snow peas because those cook the quickest. So you're just going to add those. They're going to be in there for about a minute or so before you serve it. You're going to then add the parsley, the cilantro, and the almonds. You can taste it. You can add salt and pepper if you'd like, or a little bit more tamari. And then I served it really beautifully. I put down the vegetables first, then I laid the slices of tofu on top, put a mound of couscous next to it, and it was just a beautiful platter. I recommend garnishing it with orange wedges just for a full effect. Of course, I didn't have any at the house when I was making this, but that would just, you know, round it out and look really beautiful with the dish. So, as always, I love hearing feedback from everybody when you make my food. So, if you make this dish, please come back and share it with me. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest. As I said before, Julie Castillo is an author, and her new book is called Eat Local for Less. She is also a college anthropology instructor, a children's enrichment instructor, a writing instructor, a designer, entrepreneur, and a futurist. She holds a master's degree in sociocultural anthropology from Catholic University with a specialty in gender studies and ethnopsychology. She's also a 14-year veteran of the publishing industry. She co-wrote 2 novels and 13 nonfiction books, including 2 New York Times bestsellers. And she teaches creative writing at the local community college since 2007. And I'm going to let Julie tell us more about her book and the work she's doing. So, Julie, are you with me?
Hi, Bhavani.
Hi, how are you?
All right. How are you doing?
Very good. Thanks so much for joining me. What was that?
I said thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, and you're welcome, and thanks for coming on. So I just want to start by talking about this wonderful, beautiful new book that you just came out with, Eat Local for Less. And can you first tell me what your inspiration behind writing this book was?
Well, you know, a couple of things kind of came together for me at around about the same time. So this was maybe around about 2012. I thought that was a good year to become a futurist, because if you remember back then, people were looking at the Mayan calendar and, you know, wondering if we were going to have any more future after that year.
Right.
And so futurists are people from all kinds of different disciplines who are just sort of looking ahead and trying to figure out where we're headed based on, you know, where we've been in the past and where we are today. And so, I mean, when you look at you know, the future of our society, well, when you look at the future of the world, it looks one particular way. But when you look at the future of our nation, an awful lot of it seems to come back to food. You know, we're dealing with this obesity crisis that we have, and so much of our food is processed. And so I sort of began to focus more on the food issue that way. But then also, there was an exercise that I do with my students called The Real Cost of Processed Food. And I bring in a whole bunch of processed food items, and I put them in small groups, and they have to look at these processed food items and figure out the, you know, the hidden costs in eating that kind of food, not just in terms of the hidden costs to their health, but also how much are they paying in their taxes to support the businesses that produce this food? What is the cost? What is the impact on the environment of producing a food like this, shipping all the ingredients all around? And every time I did that, it was just such an eye-opener, not just for them, but also for me. And so that got me more interested in, you know, what are the alternatives to eating processed food? And then I think one of the things that really got my attention was one day I was leaving class, and in the stairwell I found this this color brochure that was, I guess, from some kind of animal activism group that said, even if you love meat, you can still help to stop this suffering. And it was basically showing pictures of how things look inside a CAFO, a confined animal feeding operation, and the kinds of lives that animals have in the industrial meat side of things. And I had never heard of that before. I had never heard of a CAFO before. I just went, holy cow, is this really the way that our meat is produced? I had no idea.
Right.
And so looking into that a little bit more, I really began to start looking around for the alternatives. And as I started talking about what I was finding with different groups of people, what kept coming back to me was, oh, sure, you know, it'd be great to eat that organic stuff. It would be great to eat local stuff, but nobody can really afford to do that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, you know, if this is really worth doing, there's got to be a practical way to do it. And that's when I conscripted my family a little bit. I had my husband on board, and my sons at that time were about 14 or 15 years old. And I sat them down and I said, look, do you think we could try to do this for maybe about a year and just see what it does to our budget? And so we decided that we were going to go around about a year eating almost exclusively stuff that was produced within our region, and I was going to track how much money we spent on things. And they got on board with this, and we did this, and I kept every receipt for a while, kept track of everything that we bought. And Bhavani, I got to tell you, especially when we first started, because it was, you know, the winter months are the hardest months to do this, really. At first, the price went up. You know, it cost us a little more at first because we had no idea what we were doing. But as we got better at it, we learned how to eat seasonally. We learned how to make the most of the food that we were bringing home. We gradually saw what we were spending on food start to decrease. And toward the end of the year, we got to a place where we were spending about 25% less than we used to spend when we shopped at the supermarket.
Really? And that, was that because by the time you finished, you were in the summer season? Or even like if you make the full circle, you're back to the winter,
Yeah, exactly. By the time we finished, we were back into winter, but by then we had a lot more sources and we knew a lot more about what we were doing. We were growing a little bit of our own as well. And so we sort of went through a learning curve during that year.
Of course. Of course, you can't transition without going through that learning curve.
Right.
And so did you find, were you more interested in local or organic, or did they kind of go hand in hand for you?
Well, they kind of go hand in hand, and that's a question that comes up in a lot of the classes that I do on this subject. And, you know, I have to, when people say, what's more important? Is it more important to eat locally, or is it more important to eat organically?
We all get those questions, don't we?
Yeah, that's a very, very common question. And so, I mean, you have to sort of get back to what are your goals? What are you looking for? It depends on your priorities. You know, organic is really wonderful because it allows you to avoid some of the harsher pesticides and chemicals. But I find oftentimes people have expectations about organic food that it really can't meet. I mean, it's not necessarily going to be more nutritious, not necessarily going to taste better. And even checking to see that it is organic doesn't necessarily mean that it was sustainably grown, because you can actually, it's possible to grow organic food in really depleted soil. And I liked what you said earlier about the fact that you don't necessarily have to be looking for the USDA organic label, because an awful lot of producers are, they try to be as organic as they can, but for one reason or another, they forego organic certification. So sometimes if you talk to a producer for a while and find out how they're growing things, you might find that they are doing exactly what you're looking for. But what's wonderful about local food is, I think the thing that I think is most special about local food is it allows you to get involved. You know, it allows you to go to the farm itself and go see for yourself how your food is grown, to meet the people and talk to them about what they do, and, you know, also to invest in your local economy. So, and the other thing, of course, is local food is often a lot fresher than pretty much anything else that you can get.
Right. Right. You know, I love, you know, you talk about the real cost of processed foods or the real cost of food in general, whether it's processed or not, if it's being shipped across the country or up from South America. And, you know, that is something that has come across, you know, in discussion so much, because right now those hidden costs are being subsidized so often by the government to these large farm operations, and they don't have to pay the cost of those hidden costs or even the environmental cleanup from all the waste or the medical bills from people getting sick from eating that processed food. You know, all that
absolutely.
Was kind of written in, all of a sudden organic local food would be much cheaper. So where did you find in your experiment, where did you find the best places to get your local food?
Well, I'll tell you, the very first place that we found was our local food co-op, a wonderful place that we have here in town. It's kind of a nice first step for anybody who's just moving away from grocery store food, which is what we were most familiar with. A nice food co-op kind of gives you a similar experience to shopping in a grocery store. Not everything in there is necessarily going to be local or necessarily going to be organic, but a lot of them tend to specialize in stuff like that. It's also nice in terms of being open year-round. So it's a real trick, especially, you know, in New York and in our area here, to find places that are open year-round.
Where do you live?
And so, we're in Maryland. Central Maryland. And so one nice thing about a food co-op is it's there for you all the time. They often have hours that are similar to a supermarket. But I got to tell you, Bhavani, that is probably the most expensive option right there, because they have all the overhead of keeping a storefront. I will tell you also, I mean, nothing quite beats going to the farm itself. You know, it's a fun thing to do with kids or grandkids. And it's really sort of the purest local food experience you can get outside of growing your own. And, you know, there you can also bump into programs like CSAs, you know, the consumer-supported agricultural programs that allow you to actually buy a share on an ongoing basis of what the farmer is producing. And then going to local farmers markets is really great too. The one caveat there is you still kind of got to do your homework and make sure that every seller that you meet at a farmer's market actually has a farm attached to what they're doing. And actually some farmers markets kind of vet the people who sell there to make sure that everyone is represented by an actual farm. And then the probably hands down the best thing that we've found that really, really works well for a busy family like ours is if you can find some organization, some company that will deliver the fresh local produce right to your doorstep, like on a weekly basis. Uh-huh. And that is fantastic. So you set it up so you sort of get your basics. They show up right on the doorstep and you kind of automatically build your whole food life around what's in the bag every week.
Aren't those I would think those would be the most expensive, like a Fresh Direct or something like that.
Not necessarily. The one we use two locally, one that brings our produce and then one that brings our milk and eggs and bread. And their prices are competitive with the supermarket's prices. I mean, their stuff is very high quality. And one of the neat little things is that if you order regularly from them and you get, you know, a fairly good amount each week, like $50 worth, they will often raise the delivery fee, which makes the price even better.
Wow. Can you share with us what company you use?
We use a company called Hometown Harvest here locally. I don't think they're available up in your area, but they serve a lot of the Central Maryland area, and they put a beautiful bag of produce right on our doorstep every week. And then at the end of the week, we also have a local dairy who delivers for us as well, and that's South Mountain Creamery. And now, see, when I was researching for the book, I found a term that is used in the USDA called food hub. The USDA keeps track of these things that they call food hubs that are any kind of an organization that is kind of a distribution point for local food. So anybody that gathers up local food from farms and then distributes it out to the consumer. And so both Hometown Harvest and South Mountain Creamery would be considered local food hubs.
Really? And yeah, South Mountain Creamery is also organic?
No, not all of their stuff is organic. I don't think, as a dairy, I don't think that they have certification. Their animals are pastured, and I've been on their farm, and I've seen how they do things, but I don't think they have certification.
But do you know whether they are giving their animals antibiotics and hormones?
I think that they do, yes.
They do give their animals those things?
Correct, yes. Uh-huh.
And that's not a concern of yours in eating local?
I wouldn't say it's not a concern, but an awful lot of making this practical, I've found, is you sort of have to pick your battles. And because I don't eat a lot of dairy, it's one of those things that I've said, okay, if I can get this delivered to my doorstep, that's one of the trade-offs for me.
Uh-huh, right. You know, and I say that often, you know, people, like you said, you have to pick your battles. You know, for me, I found that was really important because I felt like I was giving that to my kids and I didn't want my kid. And, you know, back then, I mean, my kids are older now and they're not home eating dairy, but, you know, that's something that young people are eating a lot of. And, you know, young bodies are so much more susceptible and sensitive to the hormones and the antibiotics and the pesticides and the GMO food that the animals are being fed and all that stuff. So one of my battles for me would be to try to find dairy organic more so even than the vegetables, you know?
Absolutely. And if my kids were small, I think I would be doing that as well.
Yeah. Let's take a couple minute break. And then when we come back, I wanted to talk to you about, you know, some of the other tips that you have in this wealth of information in your book. So everyone listening, don't go anywhere. I'm talking with Julie Castillo from the book Eat Local for Less. Be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And my guest is Julie Castillo, author of the book Eat Local for Less. And before the break, we were just talking about the best places to get some of this local food. And, you know, I wanted to ask you, in your searching for all of these best places, did you also find that supermarkets had the kind of food you were looking for, or did you have to boycott them totally?
Oh, no, I wouldn't recommend boycotting them. You know, one of the things that I tried to express in the book is I'm not a 100-mile purist. I really think that there is a role to play in our modern society for a global food system. I think, you know, it's important in many ways, and I still do shop at the supermarket from time to time. And the other thing that I, especially for those things that I, you know, can't get delivered, I can't find at the local farmers market. But the other thing that I've noticed, I think this says a lot to the power of the consumer, since the local food movement has really gotten rolling. I think that it has put a certain amount of pressure on supermarket chains to offer more local food. And in the last, I'd say last 5 years or so, I've noticed that a lot more supermarket chains are trying to offer more local produce at the very least.
I agree with you on that. However, one thing I have to say is I think very often it's not, doesn't look to me to be as fresh, because I don't think they go through it as quickly as like a Whole Foods market. People are coming there looking for the organic food, so it moves quicker, you know. And same with the price. I mean, organic milk at my regular supermarket is a lot more money than the organic milk at Whole Foods, because I think Whole Foods buys it in such a larger quantity. That's my guess as to why. But I find it cheaper at Whole Foods than I do at like Pathmark, for instance.
Uh-huh, absolutely. And, you know, the supermarket food has a certain kind of a look and a smell to it. It's all, you know, it's beautiful and it's waxed and it's all the same size. And I think that's kind of what we're used to. But when you get away from supermarket produce in particular, you sort of get used to, there's a little bit of a quirkiness to the stuff that you get directly from the farm, or that you get from a farmer's market, still got a little bit of dirt on it, and sometimes it's slightly different sizes. It's got more character, and you get to a point where you can feel, you know, you can sense when it's really, really fresh.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I agree with you on that.
Yeah. So do you think the local food movement is becoming like a fad, or do you think it's here to stay, and that it's you know, that it's really going to change the way people are eating?
Well, I hope it's not a fad. I hope people aren't looking at it as a fad in particular. And I got to tell you, I've never found a way to do this that's particularly easy. You know, if you're really hooked on convenience, it doesn't come real easy. You have to kind of be committed to making a lifestyle change. And I'll tell you, one of the ways I try to get this across to people, you know, you've heard that old saw about products where they say, good, fast, cheap, you got to pick two. Well, there's one that goes for food as well. So it goes like this: cheap, nutritious, convenient. Pick two.
Uh-huh.
So if you pick cheap and convenient, that's called fast food. And it's terrible for you, you know, plus it takes a heavy toll on the environment, and the fast food industry tends to exploit people as cheap sources of labor. And I mean, we could build a whole show just around the problems created by fast food. But let's say you pick nutritious and convenient, and that's kind of the world of, you know, the boutique-y packages of things that you find in upscale grocery stores, and those are the ones that come with a really high price tag. That choice also has some environmental and economic issues. But let's say you choose cheap and nutritious. You pick that, it's not going to be very convenient. And so, you know, people who go with this option, here's where I really identify with a lot of what you said at the beginning of the show. It points you directly toward cooking. You know, Yeah. You have to involve yourself more. You have to learn more about the food. You have to invest the time in finding it or in growing it, and in cooking it and preparing it. Now, the nice thing is, I mean, once you do all that, you put all that effort into making a meal, you don't want to sit down and eat it by yourself. So right. The other thing is, it kind of points you directly towards sitting down with people and sharing a meal.
Right, because it's definitely too much work to go through for just yourself.
Absolutely.
Right? But, you know, one of the tips that I like to share with people, and I'd like to just interject a little bit, is when you make the things that are a little more time consuming, make twice as much and free some. You know, it's like, so that you have your own quick, you know, then you can have your cheap, nutritious, and convenient and have all three. And I like having all three, you know, it's like, you know, just pull it out of the freezer. It's like, so I buy glass Tupperware things that can go right from the freezer to the oven. I mean, I usually try to, you know, if I'm going to do that, I usually try to take it out the night before so it's defrosting in the refrigerator. But, you know, and I'm not big on microwaves other than for reheating my coffee. But, you know, so I will take it out of the freezer, put it in the refrigerator. But when I package things up, I'll package, like, the vegetables with the rice, with, you know, the greens or whatever. Like, I'll kind of almost create my own, I hate to use the word TV dinner, but, you know, the whole thing that I can then stick into the oven and have it for another day. Or just the things that take more time, like brown rice. You know, it takes 40 minutes to make good brown rice. So, you know, I always make, you know, twice or three times the amount and then package some for the freezer so I can take it out. Or I usually will package one for the freezer and one for later in the week because, I mean, brown rice can last in the refrigerator for, you know, many, many days, up to a week. So, you know, 4 days later, I have brown rice again, you know, and it's ready to go. And the rest of it comes together pretty quick. Like even the recipe that I shared with everybody earlier, that can be made in under a half an hour. I mean, it's, you know, couscous is one of those really quick grains. You know, it takes time to boil the orange juice in the water, and then it goes on a back burner and just has to sit there and absorb the water. You're not even cooking it, you know, and it's, so you learn which grains you can make that are quick, you know, the whole grain pastas, you know, that you can use, those are quick, but the whole grains take a little more time. So you just make double batches and that, you know, really helps, but you have to think ahead.
Yeah, that's great. And you can also, along the same lines, you can make your own, you can sort of make your own fast food. You can roll up a whole bunch of tortillas and stick them in the fridge and then just grab them on your way out the door to work or school and, you know, have your own homemade fast food.
Right, right. So, you know, people just have to, you have to plan. You know, that's one thing. You have to plan ahead and you know, stocking a well-stocked pantry. I know you get into that a bit in your book as well, you know, knowing what to have in the house so that, you know, you might have to get the vegetables, but you have the oil there, you have the tamari there, you have cans of beans there, you have certain things in your pantry so that you can whip those things together.
Right. And you also sort of plan around, you know, how much time you're going to have at home. A day that you're working at home, you know, a Saturday or something like that, that's a perfect day to whip out the slow cooker and do something in the slow cooker.
Mm-hmm. Now, as a college professor, I know you teach anthropology. Can you share with us how does anthropology go together with local food?
Oh, okay. So anthropology, the scientific study of human beings, tends to think about aspects of human life holistically. So it kind of looks at, you know, anything it's looking at, it sees it as part of an integrated system, and it definitely sees food that way. So part of what I see when I look at the way our society views food is we tend to kind of compartmentalize, and we think, you know, we think of food in terms of its nutrition or food in terms of its environmental impact, but, or, you know, the economic part of it, it's all of those all at once, you know, and they all work together as a system. So anthropology is kind of good at getting at that aspect of food. But also, anthropologists will tell you, humans don't just eat food to get fed. We make choices about what we eat. We make choices about when we eat and who we eat with. And there's a whole dimension to humans and food that is about what it all means to us. You know, it's very symbolic for us. I'll give you an example. The Maasai of Kenya and Tanzania, for whom the cattle that they raise are kind of the centerpiece of their lives. I had one of my students interview a Maasai man who said eating beef is almost like a spiritual experience for him. You know, we never feel that way about our cheeseburgers. Mm-hmm. You know, but for him, it was like a, you know, it has a spiritual dimension to it. Or the folks on the Greek island of Kalymnos, when a loved one passes away, feeding passerbys is part of what they do for the funeral ritual. They feed people this little sweet cake in the memory of the person who's passed away. Or, for instance, the Kwakiutl of the Pacific Northwest, they have a belief that the soul of a human being is in a salmon. So every time you eat salmon, it's a way to free the soul of the fish so that it can come back as a human being. So anthropology really sees eating as a symbolic act. We don't eat just because of how it tastes or how it nourishes us, but because of what it means to us. And also the other thing is, to an anthropologist, it's only a meal if it's shared. If you sit down and eat by yourself, that's not really a meal. Anytime we sit down to a shared meal, it's like a chance for us to practice the skills of living together as a community. So sitting down to eat as a meal with other people is sort of civility practice. Because, for instance, let's say you're serving a meal family style. Everybody's taking their portions from a family bowl. You don't take just as much as you want. You adjust how much you're taking to the needs of everybody else who needs to eat. And so the other thing I think anthropology brings in that's kind of neat is that throughout human history until very, very recently, food was a much more important part of people's lives. It was really central to their experiences. Because of the time that it took to grow it and prepare it and cook it and eat it, and also because of the meaning that it carried. So I think one of the neat things about getting involved in local food, because it really does require you to focus a lot more on the food that you eat, it kind of brings food back into a historically normal place for us.
I couldn't agree with you more. I don't know if you're familiar with the slow food movement, which I'm very involved with, but they look at it that way, because in many parts of Europe where, slow food grew out of Italy, it's still that way. And it's, so integral in their life that food is a part of the culture. It's brings people together and the power of food. And, I've interviewed people on my show before who also talk about the lessons kids lose by the fact that we don't have our family meals anymore. I mean, you learn so much, like what you were just talking about, of anticipating other people's needs and learning about a give and take and learning about cooperation that happens at a dinner table and certain just the social skills that happen around a table that are so integral in society working together in harmony is lost by not having our family meals. And I'm not somebody who's, really, wants the family meal from some stringent political, I'm not coming from that place, but as a way to manifest love and caring and culture and enjoying food, I think it's just such a sad state of affairs that people in families aren't sitting down together. I think it really is so impactful. So where can people find your book? You want to share that information before we run out of time?
Oh, absolutely. So you can find it at Amazon.com. And you can order it from local bookstores. Uh-huh. If they don't happen to have it on their shelves, you can ask them to order it for you.
Uh-huh. Good. Well, I just love the book, and I think it's great. Have you taken on growing any of your vegetables? I know in the book you talked about trying to maybe expand your own growing techniques since you got to experience Absolutely. So many from going to the farms. Have you gotten to try that at all?
Yeah, we sure have. Since the book came out, we've actually sold our house that was in the suburbs. We've moved a little further north. We have a little mini farm of about 4.5 acres.
Oh, how exciting.
We call it a hobby farm, although the farmers we've talked to said there is no such thing as a hobby farm. Every farm is an awful lot of work. But we're now actually getting to try some of the things that I learned about in writing the book. We have a few acres that we're working as a grass farm. So we've got alpacas, and we've also got chickens, and their eggs are absolutely fantastic. But the other thing I got to tell you is, I've been an animal lover my entire life long, and it is such a joy just to be able to share your life with animals this way.
Uh-huh.
And it's neat. It offers all kinds of wonderful rewards. And also this spring, I'm putting in some berry bushes and some raised garden beds. So it's very much a work in progress. And I can't say enough good things about how nice it is to work your own land.
How beautiful. Well, I'm so happy it's worked out for you. You know, you started by a little experiment and you just followed that path and that passion. And look at the change it's brought to you and your family. Good for you.
And, you know, I got to tell you, the neighborhood that we live in here, there's absolutely no market for my book, like right in our neighborhood, because everybody who lives here
already does it.
Eating local is kind of normal for them. It's what they've been doing their entire lives long. Yeah. Everybody around here grows their own food, raises their own meat, and sort of does everything for themselves.
That's great.
So we're learning from them.
Good. Well, we are out of time, but I want to thank you again, Julie, for joining me, and everybody listening, thank you so much for joining you. And I will see you again next week. Bye for now. Bye.
Thank you very much, Bhavani.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.